You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Although the Second City isn't doing in-person shows, classes, or events, we're doing all of those things virtually. Head over to secondcity.com and you can sign up for a class. We've got really affordable drop-in classes where you might be improvising with people from other countries. We're doing corporate workshops and events. And we have a whole new slate of virtual shows that you can get tickets to. Get more comedy in your life by going to secondcity.com. Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And. So I think you're going to enjoy the conversation today with Professor Martha S. Jones. She is the Society of Black Alumni, Presidential Professor, and Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. She's a legal and cultural historian whose work examines how Black Americans have shaped the story of American democracy. She's the author of many books, and we talk about her latest book, which is called Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Shout out to my therapist, Fred, who challenged me to invite more voices and stories that don't get heard. And this book has got these amazing characters and incredible stories and a lot of drama and a lot of violence, but also some really powerful affirming stuff as well. So I know you'll enjoy the conversation.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Martha Jones, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I know writing a book, especially one that is so rich in historical detail, can actually take some time. But did you have any sense when you started writing this book that it would be published at a time when our American culture is so squarely coming to grips with putting Black lives and stories, and in particular, Black women's lives and stories, in the center of our national conversation?
I knew that this book would be published alongside the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment. So I did anticipate there would be some conversation, but I confess that I probably anticipated a more academic, a more commemorative kind of conversation, and not one that has, you know, the profound relevance or the deep urgencies of the conversations that we find ourselves in today. I think it's important for me to say that one of the things I learned in writing this book and the experience of its reception are the ways in which those of us who write African-American history, or even early African-American history, are always talking into the present, or the present is always talking back to us, because many of the issues, including the issue of racism, are not finished questions, even as they might be set in the remote past. They're very much live questions. And so I confess this isn't the first time I've published a book that is far more relevant than I had ever imagined going into it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? Because it is a provocative read. And I mean, just in terms of some of the locations where things are happening, or, you know, the one of the things that really struck me in the book was how unsafe it was for Black women to travel.
And yes.
That simple fact is so, I don't even know. It seems unbelievable, and then it seems not unbelievable at all, especially when Black women don't seem safe in their own homes.
It's one of the things that I knew in small bits before I began this book. But I too was changed as I, if you will, strung together story after story over more than a century, and began to recognize that beginning as early as the 1850s and coming all the way forward to the modern civil rights era, over and over again, Black women in public life, Black women activists, Black women suffragists, and more, nearly everyone has a story about an encounter with violence, an encounter with threat of violence, including sexual violence. And it helps us, I think, to see clearly the politics of violence, the ways in which violence is oftentimes visited on an individual, but it is part of a politics that functions or aims to function to suppress a people.
And I do want to talk some of the about many of the women in this book. Before we do that, there's this very positive aspect of this story. And you write in the book, quote, "These insights led to a political philosophy rooted in a broad quest for freedom and dignity that extended to all of humanity." And that's a theme that runs throughout this book, is that race and sex are never, you know, they're not separated in these stories. And indeed, the call is for all humans to rise up and be better versions of themselves.
This is another of those keywords that I, again, did not anticipate. I expected words like freedom. I expected principles like equality. But this reference to humanity came up again and again, and it helped me to understand the full ambition of Black women's political thought, the full ambition of their activism, which really never was about power for power's sake, power, you know, to further my interests, which is often the ways in which we think about politics. But Black women raised the bar very high to try and set our sights on the good for all of humanity, believing, of course, that by working toward and winning the interests of humanity, their interests will be necessarily served, but not only their interests will be served.
We had Sarah Rose Kavanaugh on the show, and she wrote a terrific book called Hive Mind. And there was an aspect in there that she talks about an anthropologist looking back at the earliest groupings of human beings, and they were caregivers. We were caregivers before we were fighters. And I wonder if that has something to do with what you're talking about with this approach.
That would be hard for me to say. Yeah. but there's no question, right, that Black women's political outlook is an outgrowth of the roles that they play within their communities here, looking back to early America, and also the tensions that arise out of being caregivers, if you will, to borrow that terminology, being caregivers who see their strengths, their qualities, their contributions being overlooked and squandered. There is a sense in which Black women come to politics very much to extend that role, understanding that they won't be able to fulfill their aspirations if they don't at the same time challenge a set of conventions and barriers and practices and rituals and more that keep them from having a fuller role in public life, a fuller role in politics.
You begin the book telling a story on a January evening in 1989, Fannie Miller went to a theater in Pulaski, Kentucky. Can you tell us what happened when she went to the theater?
It's important to say it's 1889.
Oh, I'm sorry, 1889.
No, that's okay. Fannie Miller, who readers, it will be no secret to readers, is my great-grandmother. And She is someone in 1889 who has just completed her bachelor's study at Kentucky's Berea College. She has been very successful as a student and is now a teacher. And she takes herself to the theater for a night's entertainment in Pulaski. She surveys the theater, determines not to sit in the colored section, and is first accosted by an usher and then by a policeman who is summoned to put her in her place. This is an important story for me in at least two ways. One, this is not a story that was told in my family ever. Mm. I discovered this story as a historian in the early newspapers Wow. of the 19th century. And secondly, it's important because there is this moment in the story as it's told in the papers that the officer puts his hand on her to eject her from the theater. And this, to me, is that echo, right? It's that imprint of the kind of violence that is always looming, always threatening. And in her case, this is not a triumphalist story of civil rights at all. It is about a young teacher who ultimately pays the fine. In all likelihood, because to do otherwise would have put her budding career at risk. But it is a vivid reminder to me that lurking in many African-American families, including my own, is this specter of violence, including violence that's directed at women. Fanny goes on to be a suffragist in St. Louis, Missouri by 1920. While that was a difficult moment, it was not a moment that ended her hard thinking and hard work around what it means to have rights.
And the book really, in many ways, starts at the beginning of that century. And you write, quote, "In 1827, any Black woman who considered stepping into the limelight of politics was on notice. She risked family, friends, and reputation." So this was a risky choice to speak out at that time.
There's no question that there's an important stream of African American political thought that would urge Black women to conform in, to the letter of 19th century conventions about middle-class womanhood, that being a kind of strategy for winning admiration, winning appreciation, winning respect from white Americans. And so when Black women do otherwise, they are at odds with an important thread of political thought, at odds with an important tactic within Black politics. They are not going to conform to conventional true womanhood, as it was often called in the early 19th century.
So by the 1830s, Black male activists had built what I think was called a colored convention movement. And I'm wondering, how did the voices of Black women figure into that movement?
Sure. So Black women are present in the convention movement from the beginning, but they make appearances as what were called helpmeets, right? They serve the meals, they decorate the hall, they support the men who have come to deliberate. But by the 1840s, women are not only serving the meals, they are showing up to be part of the deliberations. And whatever questions they might have wanted to put on the table, whatever issues women might have wanted to raise, their very presence and the prospect that they would sit as equals to men ignites a series of contests, debates over the place of women's rights in African-American politics. And so now we've moved into the era of a companion women's movement among white American women, and Black Americans are very much at odds with one another about whether and to what degree ideas and the practice of women's rights should be incorporated into Black politics. And women are testing that a lot.
So I'd heard of Philadelphia's African Methodist Episcopal Church. That's a fairly well-known thing. I did not know about Jerina Lee.
Mm.
This is a fascinating figure. And I mean, that the story you tell about her when she's attending a guest minister's sermon, Reverend Richard Williams, she like stole a moment inside this talk. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. You know, to be a 19th century preacher of any repute, you have to have the capacity to hold a room, to hold a sanctuary, to hold a crowd in the open air. And Jerina Lee is without a doubt a very effective, very persuasive preacher, but she is being deprived of the official sanction, permission, right, from her bishop, Richard Allen, who is the founding bishop of the AME Church. So this is not just any old sanctuary, right? Mm-hmm. This is Mother Bethel Church. And she does. She takes the floor. And Allen, who has been trying to push her off, trying to dissuade her, trying to contain her, finally concedes and says, you know, her calling is as genuine as that of any man. And with that, she wins a preaching license. But the work is not done because Lee is not the only preaching woman. And very soon she will inspire more organized work by women in the AME Church who look collectively to win the right to preaching licenses.
You note in the book that in 1827, she covered 2,325 miles and delivered 178 sermons. That's incredible. And there's a circuit, right, that these people are on. That's incredible to me. We're not taught this. We are not taught this in history. And it's such a rich tale of the various ways that Black women were looking for their place and their power. And if it wasn't happening politically, it seems like they moved to the church as a place where they could begin to form those communities.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the church is important because it is that kind of space where women come organize, work collectively for many things, including around their own power within religious communities. The church is also important because it's a place of ideas. And Jerina Lee, as you know, not only travels those many thousands of miles and delivers dozens upon dozens of sermons every year, she sits down in 1836 and writes a book, a memoir, to really put her ideas to paper and to make them available much more widely. And that is part of what's important about these spaces, is that in them, women really hone their ideas about equality, about power, about their capacities and more. And Jerina Lee figures importantly, even though I think readers might be surprised to find this book beginning with a woman in the AME church, it's because the church is a place where she and many other women work out their ideas that then will influence thinking also in the secular realm.
I think one of the most unique women in the book, and there are many unique women, and I hope I pronounce her name correctly, Sojourner Truth.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an amazing name, first of all. But you write, few who met Sojourner Truth forgot the experience. What made her so memorable?
Sojourner Truth is a formerly enslaved woman from upstate New York who is free by the 1820s, comes to New York City and has an appetite for religion, has an appetite for politics, and is a always an orthodox figure who moves through many kinds of movements and utopian communities over the course of her life. But we remember her for being present for the very first of the National Women's Rights Conventions in 1850 in Worcester, Massachusetts. We remember her at those meetings because it is there that Sojourner Truth begins to carve out within women's rights circles, the unique, the distinct place that African-American women will occupy. She articulates this insistence that neither racism nor sexism should have any role to play in American politics. She does this in meetings that are largely led by white middle-class women for whom slavery might be an abstraction, but racism might be an abstraction. But it is Sojourner Truth who tells us what that lived experience was.
And she couldn't read or write, which meant that the record, she almost didn't own her own words because they weren't written down.
Truth cannot read and write. Much of her public life, she relies upon a grandson who travels with her and is her assistant. But it is true that she struggles with women who hear her speak, who interview her and more, and then record those words in ways that are not quite true to her intent. Truth will author more than anything else the production of her portrait, and her cartes de visite are legend for her very deliberate capacity to craft her image in that visual medium. It's extremely important to her as a counter to the problem of the text.
Images are interesting because they come up in the book, and we had an author on recently who was saying at one point the most photographed man in the world was Frederick Douglass, which was very interesting. And he ends up becoming kind of a huge supporter of women's rights, which I was not aware of, and that was really heartening.
Yeah, Douglass is, I think it's fair to say, a women's rights man.
Yeah.
And he comes to this in the extraordinary ferment of the 1830s and 1840s, where in New England, and especially in Western New York, where he settles in the city of Rochester, there are all kinds of enthusiasms that are infecting, in the best sense, people's thinking. Douglass is an abolitionist without question, but some of his important allies, including those who support his endeavors around publishing his own newspaper in the 1840s, are abolitionist women. And he learns his politics from them and brings them to bear in some critical moments, both within the early women's rights movement, but also in abolitionist circles. He will be in those colored conventions that we've mentioned and will be an ally to women who show up there and are looking to be part of the proceedings.
When you write about Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, there was a really, and I don't know if she actually said these words when she, in 1866, she spoke at the American Equal Rights Association. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony are in the audience. I think she did. She, this is where she says, quote, "We are all bound up together in one great bundle of humanity," which is really a lovely, lovely phrase. But she also says, quote, "You white women speak of rights. I speak of wrongs," which seems a really provocative thing to say to those women.
Yeah. Watkins Harper is a teacher and then a poet, later becomes an anti-slavery lecturer and will join the radical politics of the 1860s after the Civil War to hash out questions like political rights and women's rights and much more. She does have an extraordinary way with words, but she has come to a series of meetings of the American Equal Rights Association in the 1860s, in a sense, to confront her allies. That includes women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, men like Frederick Douglass. She's shown up, in a sense, to speak directly to the interests and out of the experience of African-American women. She will speak, for example, of being harassed while she travels on streetcars, on public roads. And she will appeal to this community, A, to stay united despite the ways in which politics seems to be fracturing their alliance. And she will make this urging that it's the interests of all humanity that should animate this old coalition rather than fractured or factionalized interests that run along lines of race or sex.
So some of the women in this are orators from the pulpit, and some are political, and some choose to really work with allies. And there's some who work in sort of the back round. And I thought Diane Nash was kind of that, who's this Chicagoan who became an activist at Nashville's Fisk University, and then really worked with King at Selma, but is not someone who was so front and center in those stories, but was like vital to what was going on there.
Diane Nash, who is still living, and I encourage folks to hear her for themselves if they have the opportunity. But Nash is a brilliant organizer, a brilliant political strategist. Yes, in the student movement in Nashville, Tennessee, while she's a student at Fisk, then moving into the Freedom Rides, and then with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, alongside figures like Dr. King and many others, she will be the architect of the Selma campaign, alongside her then husband, James Bevel. And I went looking for Diane Nash, and I was surprised. There's so much, there's so many photographs, and you know, there's film, of course, of the crossing, the brutal encounter that marchers have on the Edmund Pettus Bridge during the Selma campaign. There's so much visual material. I did expect that I would see more images of Diane Nash than I did. And it was a clue to me about of her leadership style. She's a deeply committed to nonviolent politics, and she is an organizer and a strategist behind the scenes, who contrasts with other figures of the civil rights era who are quite brilliant at using the news photographers and television cameras, importantly, to further the movement, to bring it into the homes of all Americans, including lawmakers. Diane Nash is not that figure in front of the camera, but she is essential behind the scenes.
We have a phrase in improvisation called follow the follower, and we tie it a lot to leadership and this idea that occasionally you lead from behind and occasionally you lead from front. It's rarely static. And so I found it really interesting in terms of, especially with where Black women stood in culture at different times, where they could only lead from behind sometimes because they weren't allowed those spaces. But as you move sort of forward in the story, some really interesting figures show up. And I don't know if you noticed, the Goodman Theater just mounted a couple of performances outdoors here of a one-woman show about Fannie Lou. Is it Hammer or Hamer?
Hamer, yes.
Hamer. It had to shut down because one of the production people got COVID, so I actually didn't get to see it. But this she's a fascinating figure who was, I think, a field secretary for SNCC.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you tell us about her a little bit?
So Hamer hails from rural Mississippi, sharecropper, a timekeeper, who is moved, as many Black Americans are in the modern civil rights era, to challenge the seemingly entrenched disenfranchisement of Black Americans in Mississippi. Hamer will challenge that herself among small communities of organizers and neighbors and more, registering to vote at great risk. She will pay personally, beaten by officials in Mississippi for her efforts, her challenge, right, to white supremacy there. But Hamer is another kind of organizer, founder of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, that comes together to challenge structurally the supremacy of white Mississippians in the Democratic Party. She will come to the Democratic National committee's convention in the summer of 1964 with her delegation, her Black delegation, to challenge in an effort to displace the white delegation that has been seated at the convention, a white delegation that has been selected without the input of Black Mississippians. Now, Hamer is not only calling into question local practices around the suppression and the deprivation of Black votes. She is challenging the structures of democracy at some of its highest levels by coming to the Democratic National Convention. And while her delegation will not be seated and Hamer will return to Mississippi to continue to do her grassroots voting rights work, her presence on the national stage, on national television, Hamer is someone who understands the camera and the power of the visual very well. She will change forever the place that Black Americans occupy in national politics, be part of that force that ultimately requires Congress and Lyndon Johnson to sign a Voting Rights Act in 1965.
And in another sort of thing, you're reading this now, and looking back, she actually had doctors performed a hysterectomy on her without her knowledge.
Yes.
It was so hard to read that with what's been going on right now, where you're like, oh, like.
Absolutely. This is what we mean when we say that Black women's bodies are on the line.
Yeah.
This is precisely what we mean.
All right. So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before we do that, I'm in the book. And I never heard of this happening, but it was 1922, and the United Daughters of the Confederacy wanted to dedicate a monument that was called Black Mammy of the South. So I want you to explain the situation, but I'm also curious what their intent might have been in doing that. Do you get my question?
Sure. The United Daughters of the Confederacy propose to prominently situate a monument to a mythical and degrading vision of who African American women had been in an old South, mm-hmm. in the South before slavery's emancipation. The Mammy figure was part of the Lost Cause myth. It posited enslaved women as docile, as loyal to the white families that owned them. In this dust-up, Hallie Quinn Brown from Ohio is the president of the National Association of Colored Women. And Brown says, listen, if you want to pay tribute to Black women of the past, those who were enslaved, do so by giving us the vote. Do so by giving us equal education and housing and health care and more. Right. But to take this degrading image and now turn it into, you know, bronze and situate it in the nation's capital is no tribute. We understand that as an effort to fix us, right, in time and place such that we will never be citizens. And the timing is critical because here we are 2 years after the 19th Amendment to the Constitution has been ratified. Mm-hmm. Women in the United States have supposedly gotten the vote, but of course, too many Black women in the South have not. Mm-hmm. They continue to be disenfranchised. And Hallie Quinn Brown's concern is that this monument simply reinforces the sense that Black American women are fixed in time and are not suited to full citizenship.
So in some ways, it's almost a precursor, like we could see with Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben. So these images and figures that, like, you wake up one day and you're like, "What is this? This is wrong."
Absolutely, okay. And yeah.
Wow. it was so fascinating. All right. We always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they don't get very far at all by saying no, and not even that far by saying yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
I do, and it comes out of this book we've been talking about, Vanguard. A few summers ago, a friend called me to say, have you heard about this monument that is proposed for New York City Central Park? It's a monument to the early history of women's suffrage. It's going to be unveiled in the anniversary year of 2020. It only includes two figures, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. Mm. Isn't that a travesty? Mm. I said, yes. And I think I need to write a book so that when we get to 2020, all of us as Americans will understand why that monument, which was, by the way, revised to include the figure of Sojourner Truth ultimately, why that monument is not an adequate representation or tribute to the American women who were at the start of the movement for women's rights and women's suffrage. And the result is the book we've been talking about today.
Oh, that's the perfect yes and story. The book is called Vanguard, How Black Women Broke Barriers, Won the Vote, and Insisted on Equality for All. Martha Jones, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.